నమో మహావదన్యాయ కృష్ణ ప్రేమ ప్రదాయతే కృష్ణాయ కృష్ణ చైతన్య నామ్నే గౌరతిష్వే నమః. ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ, ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ, ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. నారాయణం నమస్కృత్య నరం చైవ నరోత్తమం దేవీం సరస్వతీం వ్యాసం తతో జయముదీరయేత్. నష్టప్రాయేషు భద్రేషు నిత్యం భాగవత సేవయా భగవతీ ఉత్తమశ్లోకే భక్తిర్భవతి నైష్టికీ. So today we're reading from first canto, chapter 3, verse 24. Tata kalau sampravritte samohaya suradvisham budho nam nanjana suta kikateshu bhavishyati. Tata kalau sampravritte సమోహాయాసురద్విషాం బుధో నాంజన సుతా కికా తేషు భవిష్యతి. తథా కలౌ సంప్రవృత్తే సమోహాయాసురద్విషాం బుధో నాంజన సుతా కికాతేషు భవిష్యతి. ప్లీజ్ చాంట్. సమోహాయాసురద్విషాం బుధో నాంజన సుతా సమోహాయాసురద్విషాం బుధో నాంజన సుతా కీకతేషు భవిష్యతి. Okay, let's read the transliteration. Synonyms. Tata, thereafter. Kalau, the age of Kali. Sampravritte, having ensued. Samohaya, for the purpose of deluding. Sura, the teased. Dvisham. Those who are envious. Buddha, Lord Buddha. Namna, of the name. Anjana Sutta, whose mother was Anjana. Kikateshu, in the province of Gaya. Bhavishyati, will take place. Translation and Prabhupada by His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Then, in the beginning of Kali Yuga, the Lord will appear as Lord Buddha, the son of Anjana in the province of Gaya, just for the purpose of deluding those who are envious of the faithful theist. Maybe people can take turns to read the purport.
Lord Buddha, a powerful incarnation of the personality of Godhead, appeared in the province of Gaya, Bihar, as a son of Anjana, and he preached his own conception of nonviolence and deprecated even the animal sacrifices sanctioned in the Vedas. At the time when Lord Buddha appeared, the people in general were atheistic and preferred animal flesh to anything else. On the plea of Vedic sacrifice, every place was practically turned into a slaughterhouse, and animal killing was indulged in unrestrictedly. Lord Buddha preached nonviolence, taking pity on the poor animals. He preached that he did not believe in the tenets of the Vedas and stressed the adverse psychological effects incurred by animal killing. Less intelligent men in the age of Kali, who had no faith in God, followed his principle, and for the time being, they were trained in moral discipline and nonviolence. The preliminary steps for proceeding farther on the path of God realization. He deluded the atheists because such atheists who followed his principles did not believe in God, but they kept their absolute faith in Lord Buddha, who himself was the incarnation of God. Thus, the faithless people were made to believe in God in the form of Lord Buddha. That was the mercy of Lord Buddha. He made the faithless faithful to him.
Killing of animals before the advent of Lord Buddha was the most prominent feature of the society. People claim that these were Vedic sacrifices. When the Vedas are not accepted through the authoritative disciplic succession, the casual readers of the Vedas are misled by the flowery language of that system of knowledge. In the Bhagavad Gita, a comment has been made on such foolish scholars, avipaschita. The foolish scholars of Vedic literature who do not care to receive the transcendental message through the transcendental realized sources of disciplic succession are sure to be bewildered. To them, the ritualistic ceremonies are considered to be all in all. They have no depth of knowledge. According to the Bhagavad Gita, 15:15, Vedaisya Sarver Ahameva Vidya. The whole system of the Vedas is to lead one gradually to the path of the Supreme Lord. The whole theme of Vedic literature is to know the Supreme Lord, the individual soul, the cosmic situation and the relation between all these items. When the relation is known, the relative functions begins, and as a result of such a function, the ultimate goal of life, or going back to Godhead, takes place in the easiest manner. Unfortunately, unauthorized scholars of the Vedas become captivated by the purificatory ceremonies only, and natural progress is thereby checked.
To such bewildered persons of atheistic propensity, Lord Buddha is the emblem of theism. He therefore, first of all, wanted to check the habit of animal killing. The animal killers are dangerous elements on the path going back to Godhead. There are two types of animal killers. The soul is also sometimes called the animal or the living being. Therefore, both the slaughter of animals and those who have lost their identity of soul are animal killers.
Maharaj Parikshit said that only the animal killer cannot relish the transcendental message of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, if people are to be educated to the path of Godhead, they must be taught first and foremost to stop the process of animal killing, as above mentioned. It is nonsensical to say that animal killing has nothing to do with the spiritual realization. By this dangerous theory, so many so-called sannyasis have sprung up by the grace of Kali Yuga, who preach animal killing under the garb of the Vedas. The subject matter has already been discussed in the conversation between Lord Chaitanya and Maulana Chand Qazi Sahib. The animal sacrifice, as stated in the Vedas, is different from the unrestricted animal killing in the slaughterhouse, because the asuras, or the so-called scholars of Vedic literatures, put forward the evidence of animal killing in the Vedas. Lord Buddha superficially denied the authority of the Vedas. This rejection of the Vedas by Lord Buddha was adopted in order to save people from the vice of animal killing, as well as to save the poor animals from the slaughtering process of their big brothers, who clamor for universal brotherhood, peace, justice, and equity.
There is no justice when there is animal killing. Lord Buddha wanted to stop it completely, and therefore his cult of ahimsa was propagated not only in India, but also outside the country. Technically, Lord Buddha's philosophy is called atheistic because there is no acceptance of the Supreme Lord, and because that system of philosophy denied the authority of the Vedas. But that is an act of camouflage by the Lord. Lord Buddha is the incarnation of Godhead. As such, he is the original propounder of Vedic knowledge. He therefore cannot reject Vedic philosophy, but he rejected it outwardly because the Sura Dvisha, or the demons who are always envious of the devotees of Godhead, try to support cow killing or animal killing from the pages of the Vedas, and this is now being done by the modernized sannyasis. Lord Buddha had to reject the authority of the Vedas altogether. This is simply technical, and had it not been so, he would not have been so accepted as the incarnation of Godhead. Nor would he have been worshipped in the transcendental songs of the poet Jayadeva, who was a Vaishnava Acharya. Lord Buddha preached the preliminary principles of the Vedas in a manner suitable for the time being, and so also did Shankaracharya to establish the authority of the Vedas. Therefore, both Lord Buddha and Acharya Shankara paved the path of theism, and Vaishnava Acharyas, specifically Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, led the people on the path towards the realization of going back to Godhead.
We are glad that people are taking interest in the non-violent movement of Lord Buddha, but will they take the matter very seriously and close the animal slaughterhouses altogether? If not, there is no meaning to the Ahimsa cult. Srimad Bhagavatam was composed just prior to the beginning of the age of Kali, about 5,000 years ago, and the Lord Buddha appeared about 2,600 years ago. Therefore, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Buddha is foretold. Such is the authority of this clear scripture. There are many such prophecies, and they are being fulfilled one after another. They will indicate the positive standing of Srimad Bhagavatam, which is without trace of mistake, illusion, cheating, and imperfection, which are the four flaws of all conditioned souls. The liberated souls are above these flaws, therefore they can see and foretell things which are to take place on distant future dates.
Jai Shri Prabhupada ki. So, I just want to ask, how many of you here have had some experience with Buddhism, either in terms of practice or studying it before? Well, quite a few. That's nice. So, you can help me. Actually, I'm studying Buddhism because it's one of my minor subjects. Hinduism is my major and Buddhism is my minor. So, maybe we can discuss, first of all, what Prabhupada says in the purport. And then, after that, also, since Buddhism actually is a very popular religion, especially amongst intellectuals and the academic kind of people, so it'd be interesting to know also something, at least the preliminary concepts and practices of Buddhism and how it compares with our Vaishnava practice and philosophy. Okay, so Srila Prabhupada says that Buddha, that he did not believe in the tenets of the Vedas and stressed the adverse psychological effects incurred by animal killing. Just before I go on to that, something, you know, one of Prabhupada's pranam mantra, the second part, when you say Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshacharini. So this Shunyavadi is voidism, and it can, you know, be interpreted as like for example, the material scientists say that, you know, besides this physical elements and chemical reactions, nothing further exists. And it can also refer to the Buddhists who say that basically everything is ultimately emptiness. So it can refer to, so one of Prabhupada's mission is also to eradicate, to save the world from impersonalism and Shunyavadi voidism. So hopefully we can, Prabhupada will be pleased by our discussion today. So Prabhupada says that Buddha preached that he did not believe in the tenets of the Vedas and stressed the adverse psychological effects incurred by animal killing. Now, at the time of, even scholars and historians say that at the time of Lord Buddha, what happened was that there were lots of various kinds of philosophies and practitioners. There were those who were practicing the Vedic rituals, as what Prabhupada mentioned, you know, But they were, you know, indulging in animal sacrifices for their own upliftment, for sense gratification, to go to the heavenly planets and so forth. Because there are injunctions within the Vedic scriptures, especially the four Vedas, that do give lots of details on these sacrifices and rituals. And then there were others who were extreme renunciants. I think they were called the shamanas. So they, you know, practice extreme austerity and renunciation. And then there's still another group of people who believe that something, pravijikas or something, they believe that everything is fated. You know, we have a certain amount of lifespan. All human beings have about 8.4 million kalpas, and they even have to go through this duration of time before they can get liberation. So it's already predestined. They don't have to do anything. They just sit around doing nothing. So there's all these various philosophies were there. So Buddha, basically, he actually is, you know, he is born in a very rich aristocratic family as a prince, and then he saw one time he came out of his palace. He's protected, very protected, sheltered life. His father wanted to keep him away from all of these things, but one time he wandered out of the palace and he saw an old man. He saw a sick man, and he saw a dead person, and then he realized that this material world is actually full of misery. And then later on he saw a monk, and then he thought that maybe let me try and practice some spiritual life, because he saw that the monk was actually peaceful and happy. And then he started trying different kinds of methods. First he tried extreme asceticism, like lots of austerities, like how the jains, for example, they do. And then he gave it up. He said this is not the right path. And then he started meditating under a bodhi tree. And as he was meditating, he had many realizations. It is said that one time he was awakened to the truth, enlightened, and then he spent 1 week meditating under the Bodhi tree, and then he reflected on this notion. We call it dependent co-arising. So this means that there's a mutual condition, rise and fall of all forms of existence. And basically this means that everything comes, rises up, and then falls. Everything is temporary. And then he also came up with this idea of why does this happen? What is the cause of this? Like waves, it come up, everything comes into being, and then it's destroyed. What is the cause of this? And he basically thought of this 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising. I'm just briefly tell you what it is. So he says, first of all, ignorance gives rise to karmic disposition. First, because of ignorance, we're born into this world and with particular karmic dispositions. And then this actually gives rise to consciousness. And consciousness gives rise to name and form, or the combined mental and physical basis for existence. And then name and form, once you have name and form, it gives rise to the six sense fields of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, basically sensory and physical and mental activities. And these six sense fields gives rise to contact with particular mental and physical stimuli. And then this contact, when you have contact, for example, if we eat something, then gives rise to feelings of positive, negative, or neutral. So we begin to develop hatred, like or dislike, or neutrality towards different things. And these feelings, different things, gives rise to craving or desire for sense pleasure. Sometimes you hate something very much, sometimes you like something very much. And this craving gives rise to clinging or attachment to what one desires out of pleasure and comfort. And this clinging gives rise to basically becoming, it's called becoming, where you condition yourself to repeated lives of birth and death. And this gives rise to conception and new form because of great attachment, and you take another birth. And birth gives rise to old age and death. And old age and death gives rise to ignorance. And then again, you're born in ignorance, and the whole cycle repeats itself. So he's basically identified that this, whatever exists, is not unchanging, neither is it autonomous. It rather, like I mentioned before, it arises and falls away due to its dependence on various factors. For example, I have this body, and this body is existing because of various factors, external, internal, and so many things. And after some time, when these factors, some of these factors are no longer in place, the body perishes. And he felt that he saw this as a great suffering. He felt that rebirth and life suffering can be brought to an end by destroying the roots. And the roots he identified as ignorance and desire. And the destruction of ignorance and desire in turn destroys other links in the chain of this dependent co-arising. Once you destroy these two, ignorance and desire, everything else can be destroyed. And after this realization, he meditated and enjoyed the bliss of nirvana. And then he began to preach to his former colleagues and students, and he established the Sangha, Buddhists call it Sangha, the monastic order, as well as preaching to the lay people. And his general message was that the extremes, we should avoid extremes of sense pleasure and self-mortification, and rather one should follow the middle path, which gives rise to knowledge, peace, and enlightenment. So this is some of the philosophy of the Buddhism in general. So like what Prabhupada said, during that time, you know, people were misusing the Vedic sacrifices, people were also practicing extreme forms of asceticism. So at that time, the incarnation of Buddha was required to sort of, in one sense, deny the Vedas, but at the same time bring them back to the Vedic path, to the principles of the Vedic path, so that again they can begin to be set on a proper spiritual path. And I'm going to elaborate some more on this. You can see actually there are lots of similarities between Buddhism and Vaishnavism, and also there are some differences. I'm going to start by talking about the cosmology. In the Buddhist cosmology, there's no creator, but all the worlds that we see are mental creations of various Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. So a Bodhisattva, Buddha gains perfection, and then he has a mental creation. He creates a world, and then there are living entities who get some kind of form in those worlds, and by the grace or mercy of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, by the actions, by following the instructions, they go to higher worlds. And there are three kinds of worlds. The world of desire is the lowest level of samskaric existence. In the lowest existence, you have hells, you have ghosts, and you have animals. And then so this is called the world of desire. Higher than that is the world of form. So this comprises of 17 heavens and is divided into four groups. In this world of form, humans, asuras and suras exist. Humans, they call it titans or asuras, and gods exist, the world of form. And beyond this world of desire and the world of form, the third plane of existence is called the formless world. And this in turn is divided into four groups, each corresponding to a highly refined state of meditative absorption. So depending on the level of meditation that you achieve, you can go to a higher world. And this world is supposed to be eternal, whereas the formless, the world of form and the world of desire is temporary. So then this is the cosmology. The other thing which is common in Buddhism and Vaishnava philosophy is the concept of karma. So, in Buddhism it is believed that rebirth of all beings is governed by the law of karma. And the present existence is the result of past causes. And also they focus a lot on the nature and intention behind any individual act. And this in turn makes up the karmic seed. And in general, wholesome good actions bring good results. Bad actions or unwholesome actions brings bad results. And the three kinds of karma producing actions, physical, verbal, and mental. So this is and actually Buddhism, there are many scriptures, many scriptures in many schools, and they go into great detail about karma, what are the effects, specific effects, what exactly happens if we do a particular thing, very details. Detailed explanations of the hells and so on and so forth. So what is the method? Now there are various schools of Buddhism and various doctrines and actually hundreds of different kinds of monastic orders, but all of them share some preliminary concepts in common. And the preliminary concept, the first one is the Four Noble Truths. And the second one is the way to achieve perfection is the Noble Eightfold Path. So what are these four noble truths? The first one is dukkha. Second one is dukkha is suffering. Second one is samudaya, which is craving. Third one is nirodha, cessation of suffering. And the fourth one is magga, the path that leads to cessation of suffering. So dukkha mainly refers to what we explained just now, that birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. And association with unpleasant is suffering. And disassociation from the pleasant is also suffering. Not to get what wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates of attachment are suffering. And then there's craving. So the different kinds of craving or attachment, craving for sense, pleasure, wealth or power, and also attachment to a particular idea or worldview, like for example, communism, or you know, whatever particular idea that you have, being very strongly attached to its political ideas, and craving for existence and becoming, that you want to continue to exist, that itself is also considered to be a kind of craving, and craving for non-existence is also like a kind of a craving according to Buddhist philosophy. And the third one, the third noble truth is nirvana. Nirvana is basically the supramundane state that no relative concepts such as existence and non-existence can describe. So in other words, this concept of nirvana is something that cannot actually be fathomed. You cannot describe it in words. Sometimes it's called emptiness. Everything is basically empty. And you cannot, the moment you attach a concept or word to it, then you're actually considered to be, you know, be off the path. That's why when you know, when I think that's why when Lord Nityananda, he in his travels, he met the Buddhists, you know, he asked them some question, and then they just replied, they didn't say anything, they're just completely silent. So maybe, you know, they're saying that nothing can be, you know, can be described about what is nirvana and enlightenment. It's something that maybe something they've experienced, I suppose, according to the Buddhist thought. And then, so what is the method to get rid of this cycle of birth and death? We mentioned just now is basically to get rid of this, you know, ignorance and ignorance and greed, right? Ignorance and greed. And what is the method? The Noble Eightfold Path is the main method that's been prescribed. And what is Noble Eightfold Path? It consists of right eight different kinds of things. The first one is right understanding. That means viewing things as they are in the actual reality. In Buddhist philosophy, it would be that you know, that basically everything is empty. They'd be all just void. Everything is temporary, and ultimately everything is just emptiness. But I think this Noble Eightfold Path can also be applied to Krishna consciousciousness. So in Krishna consciousness, in Vaishnava philosophy, what would be right understanding? How would we view right understanding as? Anyone? Yeah. And more than that? Yeah, besides that, everybody. Yeah, all living entities are servants of Krishna. And second one is right thought. So right thought refers to thoughts of selfless detachment, goodwill, and non-violence. So this is a non-violent, one of the, non-violence comes up many times, that's what Prabhupada has mentioned, because Buddha wanted to bring them away from the path of animal killing to the path of non-violence. So right thought means thoughts of selfless detachment, goodwill, and non-violence. So in Vaishnava practice, what would be right thought? Yeah, thoughts of Krishna and also attachment to Krishna and thoughts of serving Krishna. And the third one is right speech. And this refers to abstain from harmful or unprofitable speech. So how would that... Huh? Prajalpa, what else? Blaspheming, criticizing. This is a negative aspect. And then the positive aspect is glorifying the Lord, glorifying the devotees. And the fourth one is right action, which means abstain from immoral deeds like killing, stealing, and illicit sex. So in our Vaishnava context, what would be right action? Besides this, we have something else, right? What is right action in Vaishnava context? Devotional service. Devotional service to, you know, to Krishna, to the Guru, to Vaishnavas, and also Jiva Doya, giving mercy to the living entities. Right livelihood, which means refrain from harmful professions like trading in weapons, human trafficking, slaughtering animals, selling intoxicants. So this basically, you have to have a profession that is honest and sinless. Right effort, refers to endeavoring to remove negative thoughts, developing good thoughts, maintaining a favorable object of concentration when meditating. So in Krishna consciousness also, we also try to think positively, always depending on the mercy of the Guru and Krishna. And there's no need for pessimism in Krishna consciousness, because we know that Krishna and Lord Chaitanya is always very merciful and helping us. And right mindfulness, this is interesting. So right mindfulness means clear and steady awareness of how one speaks, acts, and thinks. That means basically becoming very aware of oneself, what we're doing. So in terms of devotional service, how would we apply that?
Look at our motivation. What if we do something, why we are doing that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Anything else? Also, I think, like, for example, when we are doing, like, devotional activities, when we are singing kirtan, or we are, you know, whatever service we're doing, to be absorbed in it, to concentrate, you know, and be aware of how we're acting, thinking, and so forth. So we are actually absorbed in the service. And the last one is right concentration. Right concentration is basically cultivating an unbroken attentiveness to the object chosen to focus the mind and the subsequent development of tranquility. Whatever you're meditating on, complete attention on that. In the same way, we can also apply it in our Krishna consciousness when we chant our japa, by concentrating on the holy name, and also when we're hearing like that. Yeah. Can you elaborate on that, please?
What was the description of the last one?
Well, they call it right concentration, which means cultivating an unbroken attentiveness to the object chosen to focus the mind, and subsequent development of tranquility free from distractions.
Yeah,
like total
unmotivated, uninterrupted, devotional service, one-pointed attention on Krishna consciousness. That's technically samadhi. Mm.
Right. Thank you for that. So, any questions up to this point about Buddhist philosophy or practice? Yep.
I just wanted to say that I was listening to one lecture quite some time ago about Buddhism and Krishna consciousness. And I can't even remember who was giving the lecture, but they were describing the Eightfold Path as basically the mode of goodness. Like, it's basically, you know, talking about right livelihood, you know, not like selling intoxicants, basically trying to elevate people to the mode of goodness, from what I understand.
That's a great point. Also Prabhupada mentions in the purport that basically Buddha laid down these principles of non-violence and moral actions. All of these things help you come to the mode of goodness so that you can elevate yourself further spiritually. So now I want to go on to the next section, which is basically Buddhist critique of Vaishnava philosophy. Now, I haven't found anything where Buddhists or the Buddha is specifically criticizing Vaishnavism, but based on some of the stuff which I read, we can make some extrapolations. Of what would a Buddhist say if he were to meet a Vaishnava, you know, if they were to engage in some kind of a debate, based on the teachings and also the discourse that the Buddhists and Buddha and other Buddhists have had in history. So the first one is the concept of no self, anatta. So according to Buddhism, there's no permanent self apart from the mind and body. And one is misled by thinking that because I desire, this notion of I must refer to something concrete, lasting, or real. So this idea that, oh, because I have this feeling, I want to desire, I want this I is always coming. So this I, feeling of I, must be something that is real. But no, actually there is no I. There's only everything, what we are made of is actually made up of five aggregates. Form, feelings, perceptions, disposition, and consciousness. And consciousness refers to the unreflective awareness of the self. And this idea of the self, this idea of the permanent self, is actually very dangerous because it leads to the idea of me and mine, which reinforce greed and desire. You know, if I'm always thinking that such a thing as I is existing permanently, then I'll always be thinking, what is in it for me? How can I achieve success? What is good for me? So this brings about a very feeling of selfishness and desire, yeah. There is no permanent self in Buddhistic terms. Yeah, there is, the whole idea is to negate the permanent self. The whole idea is to negate this form, feelings, perceptions, dispositions, and the consciousness of that I exist. Yeah.
How does does the cycle start then? Because I can see how from one lifetime to another, because you have that those desires, even if it's an impermanent self, but at some point it has to, like, you have to enter into the cycle. So if there's no permanent self to enter into the cycle, like, how does the whole thing, how does the whole thing start?
This is an interesting question. I want to discuss it later, but since you brought it up, this question was asked by one of Buddha's disciples. So one of his disciples asked him, he said that, please tell me, you know, is this notion of self, is it eternal? Is after death, does the Buddha himself, does he continue to exist? And is this material universe eternal? So then the Buddha replied that, the disciple actually told him, if you cannot answer these questions, I'm going to leave this part of Buddhism. and then the Buddha replied, okay. So he said that, he gave an analogy. He said that in the one time there was this person who was struck by an arrow. And then, so his friends, relatives called a surgeon to come and remove this arrow. And then, but the person who was struck by the arrow started asking the question, oh, who struck this arrow? And what is the arrow made of? Is it made of metal? And what kind of what kind of poison is put on the tip? And when was it struck? And from which direction? So I started asking all these questions, and instead of trying to be cured from being struck by the arrow, so his point was that, look, you know, all these questions of whether the self is permanent, whether the universe is permanent, whether the Buddha himself continues to exist, it's irrelevant, it's unbeneficial to ask these questions. All I can tell you is that there's suffering, there's birth, there's disease, so try to get out of it instead of thinking about all these things. that's his response to it.
That's kind of like Prabhupada's, you know, he talks about drowning in the ocean. Like, if somebody throws you a life vest, you don't question. It's like you don't try to understand, how did I get in this ocean?
Yeah.
It's like you're just concerned about grabbing the life vest and getting out.
Yeah, that's true. But if you look at it in another way, if we're going to counter this, we can also say that if, for example, if you go to a doctor and the doctor wants to find, you know, a good doctor won't just try to cure the symptoms; he'll try to get to the root of the disease. And you know, from the Vedic scriptures, we understand that the main reason why we're here is because we choose to turn our face away from Krishna. We choose to forget Krishna, right? So that's why. Then that's the root cause of our material existence. So, and our whole Krishna conscious philosophy is trying to get rid of this ignorance that we are separate from Krishna.
So, does he care about what will happen, like when they attain the perfection, what will happen then? They will just annihilate?
So this, what will happen is, this empty, like what I mentioned, this emptiness, nirvana, is very difficult and very difficult concept to define. So, basically it is negation of the self, we can call it like that. And then also, the next thing that Buddha said was that he denied all Brahminical claims to superiority and purity based on birth. And he said that measure of greatness is located instead in morality and a person's conduct. And he said that Vedic sacrifices are unnecessary and immoral when taking the life of an animal. And these rituals that the Brahmins indulge in are nothing but acts to obtain wealth and food for themselves. So, what is our response, our Krishna conscious response to this?
We agree?
Okay. And what about, because there's one time when Buddha said that the Brahmins are claiming that they are coming from the mouths of the Purusha, of the Supreme, and the Shudras are coming from the feet. But I see that both the Brahmins and the Shudras are coming from the womb of a mother. So what are they talking about? Yeah, so how do you respond to that? Yeah, by qualification and karma, by guna and karma, right?
Yeah, a good Brahmin will have a good conduct also. So in that way, he's correct.
So it's not just by birth. And then the next one is that there's no creator. And according to Buddha, Brahmins have failed to recognize that there's actually endless cycle of destruction and recreation. And they've mistakenly accepted that Brahma created the universe. This theory says that when Brahma was born, after he was longing for company, and when other beings began to be reborn in this world, the Brahma deity mistakenly thought that he brought them into being, when in fact they were simply reborn in the world from a formless realm when the time was right for them to be reborn. So in other words, there's no creator. This is an endless cycle of, you know, destruction and creation. So there's no question of a creator. And we're just imagining if it's... And this whole idea of religion is that, you know, they say that... actually, this is discussed by the Buddha also, or at least attributed to him, that how in the beginning everybody was sharing the food and everything, but later on when people started hoarding food and then people started stealing food, then they developed this idea that we must have some kind of a law, and they use, and basically they said our ancestors is God. You know, they made a deity of the ancestor and started worshipping the ancestors and said this is God, whether it's Brahma or whoever it may be. This is our God, and therefore we have to, he's our creator, and we have to, there are these rules and laws we have to follow, otherwise we'll get in, you know, we'll be punished. So this whole concept of religion is nothing but a system constructed or invented just to organize society. And this is a very academic way of thinking also, or just organized society. So how do you respond to that?
If you read in between the lines of what he just said, he said that it's destruction and creation, but without creation, you need a creator, because creation means you have a creator. So if you look at it, sometimes people will be in power, like today's scientists would be empowered to say, oh, there's no creation or there's no creator because it's just creation and death, destruction and everything. So then they'll run with that. But if you look, and if somebody really reads in between the lines, you'll see without, if there's creation, there has to be a creator. It just kind of says that to you. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
But other people will use it to their advantage, and that's the purpose of it.
You mentioned that the Bodhisattva is the creator.
Yeah, what bodhisattvas are those beings who have made a vow that they will not be liberated until they've liberated everybody else. So then they do lots of pious activities and they gain lots of merit to the point that they're able to create their own mental worlds, and then other living beings inhabit this world and they guide them back to nirvana. That's the idea of bodhisattva.
So the creator is actually, then of this universe, is a bodhisattva somewhere meditating under
it. Yeah, the Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha.
And then if you become a successful Buddhist yourself, you also become the bodhisattva of your own creation.
Yeah, you can either do that or you'll join the Buddha in his own world along those lines until you attain nirvana.
This is reminiscent of Mormon philosophy, actually. The Mormons teach the same thing, that if you become a perfected being, you become first the Jesus and then the God of your own universe.
Right, okay, yeah. Yeah,
like Brahma.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Does anyone know the literal definition of nirvana?
The definition of nirvana is near as without, and nirvana is the force, you know, outside of the force of entanglement.
Oh, okay. I see. Outside of the force of entanglement.
That's what I heard.
Okay.
Nirvana comes in the Bhagavad Gita also.
It sounds similar. I mean, what she was giving the literal definition of it, but the meaning is a similar concept. Okay, and then, so the Buddha also taught that the creation is a natural and cyclical process that occurs without any divine intervention. So, and you know, in Singapore, we organized a conference called, what is it called? Origins of the Universe. So we had a Buddhist speaker, Life in the Origin of the Universe. So we had a Buddhist speaker, a Muslim speaker, we had a devotee, and then we had a Christian who was a moderator. So then the title of the Buddhist speaker, can anyone guess what's the title of the Buddhist speaker? Is it the title of his talk? The title of the forum is Life and Its Origin. So what would his title of his talk be? His title is Why Bother? Yeah. So anyway, then, so besides this, I also have a list of arguments based on Prabhupada's purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, and also some of my own additions to it. The first one is, by our own practical experience, we have to accept the beginning of creation, and when we accept the beginning, we must accept the creator. This is what I think somebody said, right? And Second one is, if everything is emptiness, there's no need of arguments and debate. The Buddhist philosophy depends on argument, but there can be no argument if one simply depends on I am. There must be a you or another person also. Again, this is one of Prabhupada's words. So he's saying that if everything is emptiness, or everything is nothing, there's no need to argue anymore. If you are nothing, I am nothing, everything is empty. So why, and eventually everything is going to go back into emptiness, so why bother trying to make distinctions of I'm the teacher, or I'm the monk, and you're the layperson, I'm the teacher, and you're the disciple. There's completely no need for this kind of distinctions. Everything is ultimately empty. And the third one is, I think Rasaraj Prabhu alluded to this, the Buddhist cult accepts the philosophy of transmigration, but the Buddhists do not properly explain the next birth. So what is it? So we die, we are made of these five aggregates, but what is it that transmigrates? What is the thing that continues to take on a new body and a new, different karmas are transferred? What is that? What is that concrete substance that actually is transmigrated? Within the Buddhist philosophy and doctrine itself, this is a huge debate. Until now, they decide they don't want to admit that there's eternal self, but at the same time, they cannot admit it. Explain it very, very well. So then they have all kinds of debates based on this. Sometimes they say there's some kind of, some schools have actually admitted there's some kind of consciousness that transmigrates because they cannot explain it properly. And then, fourth one, the Buddhists theorize that annihilation or nirvana is the ultimate goal. Annihilation applies to the body, but the spirit soul transmigrates from one body to another. So this is, so it's not that perfection means one's existence becomes void or zero. Existence continues. But if you want to positively annihilate the material body, we have to accept the spiritual body. Otherwise, there can be no eternality for the soul. So it's not just negation. There's some positive engagement for the soul as well, which is devotional service. And the fifth one, according to the Buddhists, the Vedas are compiled by ordinary human beings. There was no person in the beginning of the creation other than Brahma. Yet Brahma himself glorifies the Vedas, right? He talks to the Vedas and all of these things. So if you say there's no, the Vedas came from ordinary human being, how is Brahma, basically accepting the authority of the Vedas himself?
Well, that's also made up, after people, they said that Brahma is God, then right. They can say Brahma is glorifying Vedas.
Yeah, it can be argued that way. But basically, we can say the conclusion is the Vedas are not compiled by any created being, because if you accept Brahma and you accept what he says, you accept that Brahma actually said these things, then you cannot come to the conclusion that the Vedas were created by ordinary human beings. So Prabhupada says, we cannot accept the theory that the Buddhist philosophy, Number six, the Buddhists emphasize on mercy, but mercy or compassion is only relative in terms of emptiness. There's lots of emphasis on becoming compassionate, trying to save other people, but even this compassion, why focus so much on compassion if everything is ultimately empty? This compassion is also a relative feeling if everything is ultimately non-existent.
Teaching side, like, are they at all interested in being compassionate towards those who are not familiar with the philosophy of Buddhism and bring them towards them?
Yeah.
And in that case, who are the people who are interested in following this philosophy? Like, what interests them into taking this up?
Well, those who are frustrated from material life, they want to, one of the purposes of Bhagavad Gita, it is Prabhupada writes that sometimes you're so frustrated from material life, sometimes people, take paths which bring them to spiritual suicide, negate the self.
So, does faith play a part? How much does faith play a part in this and experience as such about?
Well, according to the Buddhists, officially they say that faith is not important, it's the practice that's important, and by practice you get, you develop your realizations. Okay, I'm just going to go on, just two more points, and then we can open for questions. So the next thing is that the fact is that we're all hankering for pleasure. Our Vedic Vedanta Sutra says Anandam Mayo Bihasat. All living entities are hankering for pleasure. So, but the Buddhist method of just negating the senses in the mind will not bring happiness, nor is it a permanent state. So we need much, much more than that to much more positive engagement to give us pleasure, which is spiritual in nature and permanent. And number eight, the next one is that the basic principle of the living condition is that we have a general propensity to love someone. So in Buddhism does not address this propensity. And there's no information where to repose the loving propensity so that everyone can be happy. But then in Krishna consciousness, we say the missing point is Krishna. Krishna is the subject of our love. And finally, the last point is that for what Prabhupada mentioned, actually Lord Buddha, he came to make the atheist theist, because he is the incarnation of God, and ultimately they began to worship him. So for all the talk of nothingness and emptiness, the Buddhist cult, if you actually analyze it, is actually a very devotional cult. Like if you go to many temples, I've been to Thailand, Indonesia, and even Sri Lanka, you'll see all these grand temples and the huge deities of Buddha, you know, and they venerate him, they venerate his relics, you know, his various, there are many stupas constructed. And I'm just going to give you one example from one of their texts, which a disciple of Buddha, he replies, you know, when he's asked this question, you're not having physical association of the Buddha, so how are you managing? So his reply is like this. He said that, there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gautam. Gautam is Gautam Buddha. So there's no moment for me, however small, that's spent away from Gautam, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, with constant and careful vigilance. It is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. So they're constantly meditating on Buddha. So in other words, Lord Buddha in one sense cheated them to take up the cult of devotional service. So my point is that why do you want to eat like this? Why can't you just eat this way by take prasadam, you know, chant and discuss Krishna's beautiful pastimes and be happy in that way? So, yeah. Some other problem? I think so. I completely agree. I think if you see some knowledge somewhere, in any way, even if it comes from whatever, if it's going to be helpful to you, anything that's favorable to your devotional service, we should accept. So if we can apply them, Krishna consciousness, why not? Damodar Prabhu, you had something to say?
Thank you. I have a comment and a question. There was a question raised about faith for the Buddhists, and you'll find that they're very proud and boasting how everything's very scientific and just experiential. But their path directs you towards a state which cannot be described by words, understood by the intelligence of the mind. And they depend on literally contradictory statements, like what is the sound of one hand clapping, in order to realize that. So I find that it is a matter of faith. And that although they're directing you towards supreme existence, it's lacking substance. So that's why the Bhagavatam, it points out, what is that vastu? What is that substance? Tattvam yajnanam advayam brahmiti paramatmiti bhagavaniti shabhyate. So Bhagavatam points out that the truth is Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And I noticed that, because there's different degrees of revelation of those aspects in philosophy, you know, for the Brahmavadi, they accept Brahman. For the Buddhists, they don't accept anything. So to the degree that you negate these three aspects of the absolute truth, you just have contradiction in your philosophy.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And then my question, though, is kind of a doubt. A lot of times when you find Srila Prabhupada or Acharyas describing the Buddhist philosophy, they put it in such a completely different terms than the Buddhists do, that it seems as if they've never actually heard the Buddhist philosophy. So In your experience, especially reading the Chaitanya Charitamrita and Prabhupada explains 10 principles of Buddhism, do you find they match?
Well, not 100%, actually, because that is actually from Bhaktivinoda Thakur's presentation. But at the same time, there are so many various strands of Buddhism, so I'm just guessing that where Bhaktivinoda Thakur would have taken it from was something which I didn't come across. Because I'm studying more like Mahayana Buddhism and stuff, so there may be some differences. Within the Buddhists themselves, there's so many differences of opinion and doctrines. Clayton Prabhu?
Nama Brahmani Vaishnave Swarupani Vatam Rajan Vishwasuna Vijayate Sharira Vidyajay Durindya Tahikai Jive Phile Visa Sagore Taramate Jivati Lobomoy Sudurmati Abhijita Katina Samsare Krishna Muradu Purivari Jivadoy Swapasadana Dilobai Sela Mutapau Radha Krishna Ganaga Premida Kosi Chaitanya Nitai Jaini Vai Jaini Tai Shiva Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Could we go back to the issue of nirvana? Okay, so I was looking it up in the Bhagavad Gita here, and it's in at least two verses, and then Prabhupada mentions it in the purport to another verse. The full definition Prabhupada gives in the purport to verse 72 of chapter 2, the last line of that verse is Brahma Nirvanam Richati, and he translates, it's like a compound. The word doesn't appear by itself in the verses, it appears with another word. So this is Brahma Nirvana, and it's the spiritual kingdom of God. And then in 6:15, there's Nirvana Paramam, which means the end of material existence. But concerning the... I don't know where you heard that it's Nir and then Vana, like forest, but it's not at all the same word. Vana... It's a different spelling and everything. Vana is forest, but Vana is—it's not at all the same word. So, but there's no like breakdown of what exactly the elements of the word means. Mm-hmm. But Prabhupada says that Nirvana means to put an end to material existence. According to Buddhist philosophy, at the end of our existence in this world, there's just emptiness. But the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita is radically different. True life only begins at the end of material existence.
Was Buddha born a conditioned soul, or is he considered a nitya?
There's a huge debate within the Buddhist philosophy. Like some people say that, what is understood is that in general a person practices. For many lives, there's actually this Jataka tale, stories of the Buddha's previous birth, where he was a great king, sometimes an animal, and so on and so forth. And after achieving enough merit, he comes to this heavenly kingdom called the Trishta, something like that, Tataksha, something like that. So then, and then he waits to be reborn, to be born in this world. So in that way, the future, the same way there's a Buddha for coming for the future, his name is Maitreya Buddha, he's waiting in the heavenly doors for his time to come, and he will come in the future, the Maitreya Buddha.
So some people say many lifetimes he's come to this point. Yeah. Others say it's a direct, somehow empowered by God, or...
No, because there's no conception of God. But they do accept that you can go to the Buddha lands, pure land Buddhism, there's various kinds of Buddhas, Amitabha Buddha, and by practicing devotion to him, you take birth in his planet.
But the question on you is that he is an empowered incarnation of God.
Yeah, incarnation. Saktivish Avatar. Yes, please.
Who wrote the literatures for Buddha?
Oh, there are many, the hundreds and thousands actually. And in fact, it's continuing because as Buddhas, it's only recorded about 200, 300 years after that. And also, the philosophy is that anyone can become a Buddha. So, anyone can become a Buddha, anyone can write scripture. So, that's the thing. In the purport, Prabhupada writes that Buddha was born 2,500 years ago in Bihar, but the Buddhists and the scholars believe that Buddha was born in Lumbini in Nepal, And they've dated it somewhere between, you know, around 6th century BC or perhaps 500 BC. But the thing is, for me, it's not so much of a contradiction because within the Buddhist doctrine itself, you have many Buddhas. So some say that this Gautama Buddha is the 6th Buddha and some say he's the 25th Buddha. So there have been many previous Buddhas before the one which is popular today. Yeah, that's a good point. But I guess the Buddhist response is that this identification with the self itself is bringing you so much suffering because you want to exist. So because you want to exist, you have to take birth again and again and suffer all the concomitant things that come with being born again. Because suffering is something that's felt, right? That's how they respond, I guess. So. Yeah, that's also interesting kind of view. Yeah.
To.
You can't. Yeah, you can't. Even the desire of liberation has to be given up. Also, according to the desire for nirvana has to be given up.
Does Buddhist philosophy say that one can achieve nirvana before leaving this body?
Yes, there are some schools that say it's something they can immediately achieve. Some say that it has to be achieved after a very long time. So,
like in another lifetime?
After a very long time. There are different opinions on this. Some say, Zen Buddhism especially says that you just have to, it's a question of, if you just immediately understand that you have the Buddha nature within you, you're already enlightened. There are some who say that you cannot attain nirvana in this life, you have to take birth in a Buddha land, and then by association with the Buddha, then you can attain nirvana. So the different opinions on this. I just want to end by... Because the Buddha he already attained enlightenment, and then from the place where he had attained enlightenment, is waiting to be reborn here as a Buddhist, you know, like to out of compassion to deliver the other living entities. So I just want to end by quoting this very nice. Now that we know the similarities and differences, how do we interact with Buddhists? I want to, or in fact, people of any other religion. This very nice quote from Bhaktivinoda Thakur from Jeva Dharma. Please allow me to quote it, and then I'll end here. He says. Jeva Dharma chapter 8, he says, actually there's no dharma other than Vaishnava dharma. All other religions propagated in the world, including those to be propagated in future years, factually comprise different steps upon the ascension to Vaishnava dharma. The devotee should respect that religion in accordance with its degree of purity. Thus, the followers of those religions, which actually constitute different stages on the path to pure Vaishnava dharma, must be accorded proper appreciation and respect. And on the other hand, while dealing with groups that have deviated from pure Vaishnava dharma, one must never bear malice, but engage oneself in the culture of one's own devotional truth. Thus, devotees should never be hateful and show intolerance towards other religious practices. Thank you. Hare Krishna.